From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're starting the hour with the concept of killer robots, which is more reality than concept than you might think.
Today, researchers from around the globe signed a letter warning the world about the danger of using artificial intelligence as a weapon of war. Tech entrepreneur Elon Musk and physicist Stephen Hawking added their names to the letter, which was published at the world's biggest artificial intelligence meeting of the year going on in Argentina. And joining us on the line on Skype from Buenos Aires is one of the signatories of the letter, Toby Walsh, a professor of AI at the University of New South Wales. Toby, give us the argument that you lay out in this letter.
The argument is now is the time to think about putting a ban on offensive autonomous weapons. If we don't do this now, there's likely to be an arms race, and that's going to be a very bad thing for mankind.
When you say offensive autonomous weapons, what are you talking about?
The sort of thing we're talking about is a drone that's controlled completely by a computer. So at the moment, we do have drones being remotely controlled, but there's still a human in the loop making that critical decision of life and death of whether to fire a gun or a missile. But we really think it's would be taking it to another level to remove humans, and it would be escalating the arms race if we did. Some people have thought this is the next revolution in warfare, that we had bullets, gunpowder, nuclear bombs, and this would be another way of completely changing, transforming the way that we fight war, making it far too efficient and far too deadly.
Why? Why is there such a difference between a drone that is piloted by a human on the ground and one that is completely autonomous?
Well, completely autonomous, that would mean that they will likely to be far more efficient. There's likely to be many more mistakes, certainly with the technology at the start. I'm actually more worried about stupid AI than I am worried about smart AI. Till the technology is very good, we can't be sure. Some people have argued that, you know, computers will be much more selective. There is some argument to that, but there's also the risk that it's going to just escalate. This is technology that's actually quite cheap. You can go down to a hardware store and buy yourself a cheap drone. And so likely there's going to be, you know, many of these autonomous weapons in the battlefield if we don't put a stop to them now.
Are countries around the world already trying to do this with existing technology, trying to have autonomous weapons?
Certainly there's research going on, and there's a certain amount of autonomy in weaponry out there, which is why we really it's important today to think about these issues, that we could take some time to get a ban in place. And of course, it's not just conventional armies that we're worried about. As soon as this technology is available, it will be sold by arms companies, and it will fall into the hands of terrorist organizations. And that will be a very bad thing.
Well, how close are we at this point?
Some people would already argue that we have certain types of weapons which are largely autonomous. But even if you take a very strict view, it's only a few years away. This technology is finding its way, advancing very rapidly.
Do you think that you and the other scientists who've signed on to this letter will be listened to, and all the warnings that you're raising will be heard?
We very much so hope so. I mean, what's new here is that more than 1,000 of my own colleagues, the researchers who are working in this field, have come together. It's been a groundswell movement to sign this letter. It's very interesting to see people like Stephen Hawking sign the letter. But we're talking here now today about the serious AI researchers working, roboticists working on this problem, who have themselves said. And so we very much hope that United Nations and various other people listen to our concerns.
Well, and a lot of people listening to you right now on this program may think, well, artificial intelligence is a net negative. If this is the kind of thing that people are trying to do with it, why do we want it? You're at this huge conference of artificial intelligence going on in Argentina right now. What will the benefit be of having AI for humans?
Well, it's a really exciting time to be in AI because there are also lots of really good news stories here. We've been hearing today, I was hearing a talk about how AI algorithms are being used to increase the number of lung transplants you can do. And there are many other applications. I like to think, you know, one day we'll be able to put in a smartphone diagnosis tools so that you can take into the third world first world healthcare. And that will be a really good thing. People sadly are dying needlessly around the world for things that we know how to fix, things we know how to fix with pennies. And if only we could actually get some smarts out there to those people, that would be a good thing.
That's Toby Walsh, a professor of AI at the University of New South Wales and NICTA, joining us from this big AI conference in Buenos Aires. Toby, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, we wanted to get more reaction today to that decision by the Boy Scouts of America to end its ban on gay adult leaders. Yesterday, we spoke with an Eagle Scout who'd been pushing fellow Scouts to be more inclusive, and he welcomed the move. Today, someone who's against it on religious grounds. Now, about 70% of Boy Scout troops are sponsored by churches. The new policy allows them to continue a ban on gay adult leaders. But that exclusion may not be enough. The Mormon Church, which sponsors more troops than any other organization, says it's considering starting a competing program for boys. And there already is one. John Stemberger chairs the board of Trail Life USA. That's a Christian scouting program that was started after the Boy Scouts' decision in 2013 to allow gay youth to participate. And John, welcome.
It's great to be with you.
And as you well know, the Boy Scouts of America president, former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, said that this is an issue that divided Scouts, that the ban wasn't inclusive, but also not sustainable, that there would be even more lawsuits against Scouting than there are, and that Scouting would lose. There is gay marriage in the U.S., legal across the U.S. right now. Why not gays leading troops?
Well, this is a very sad day in my judgment. The purpose and the mission of the Boy Scouts of America, which they rarely talk about, is to really prepare young people to make ethical and moral choices. And so what are we saying to young people when we just look at the polls and what's popular to determine what our values and morals are going to be? And that's the problem with the decision. It is unsustainable, but it's unsustainable for churches, I think, because they're going to undergo risk and liability that they've never had before.
So it sounds like you're saying, because I was going to ask, why isn't the exclusion for churches good enough? And it sounds like you're saying that you feel that churches, despite the exclusion, will still be sued and that will be a burden for them. But you talked about how scouting is supposed to be, you know, about morals. But why can't people have their own view of what morals are? Nobody's asking, you know, let's say Christian Scouts who don't believe in gay rights, nobody's asking them to adopt them.
Well, prior to this compromise on the Boy Scouts of America part, there were people, both adults and young people, with the same-sex attraction in scouting. Everybody knew who they were, but they were appropriate. They were discreet. They didn't act out. They didn't make a big deal about it. Under the new policy, they can be now openly gay. In America, that means flaunting. That means sexual innuendo. Completely inappropriate behavior in a youth program.
Well, hold on a second. I think we have to respond to that, because being openly anything, I mean, nobody can be flaunting sexuality, even if they're heterosexual, in a Boy Scout troop. That would be inappropriate. So I think it just means not being secretive.
Well, I would disagree with that. I mean, you look at anything that has the title gay on it, and it's usually inappropriate, has innuendo, and it inserts sex. I mean, it makes it the big deal of the day. And so it's just inappropriate. Kids should not be around a campfire learning about what homosexuality is. That's an appropriate discussion for parents, not within the scouting program.
I have to ask, John, because many people in America know gay and lesbian people who never mention their sexuality. It sounds like you're referring to a caricature of it. Do you know gay couples or lesbian couples?
Sure, I sure do.
And yeah. Do you think
in my family, outside my family, yeah?
Do you think they flaunt that they're always speaking of their sexuality? Is that your experience?
Well, if you look at magazines, look at TV shows, you look at parades, you look at these things, and they're not discreet. Yeah. And that's inappropriate for a youth program.
Well, again, maybe many people might see a television program as not reflecting real life. But meanwhile, your organization, Trail Life USA, we understand much of the organization is made up of homeschooled kids. In our reading of accounts, scriptures are used during camping trips. It sounds wonderful. I went to church camps myself. But are you concerned that what you're doing is limiting young people in an increasingly diverse world? Put aside a young gay person or a gay scout leader, a Buddhist, for instance, may not be comfortable in an organization that has Bible scripture. It just limits young people in a world that's becoming increasingly diverse.
Well, actually, in our program, we will allow any boy of any faith We will allow a boy that has a same-sex attraction or even has gender issues. We will even allow an atheist boy for the reason that we want to influence that young man and show him that the beauty of the creation screams that God exists and try to help him to think clearly about that issue.
What happens if the Mormon Church also starts their own club? You've got yours. Are you the ones who are destroying Boy Scouting?
No. The Boy Scouts of America has made a very sad decision. And in fact, it feels to me like part of America dies as a result of this. This is a cherished institution that is literally going to gut its own membership. If the Catholic and the Baptist Church leaves in addition to the Mormon Church, then it's really going to be a sad thing. This institution is now basically defying its own law and its own oath and 104 years of tradition.
That's John Stemberger, chair of the board of Trail Life USA, a Christian scouting program started after the Boy Scouts of America allowed young gay youth into their organization, and obviously against the recent lifting of the ban on gay leaders. John, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And now, a dramatic story of man's destructive impact on wildlife and the humans who risk their lives, I think it's fair to say, to undo that damage. I'm referring, of course, to hummingbirds and the rehabbers who take them in. Hummingbirds are those tiny, multicolored, iridescent engineering miracles. They can spiral up into the air and dive back down at 60 miles an hour. But those wings that beat into a blur need a lot of calories to survive. When they're injured, they have to be nursed back to health before release. If they're newborns without parents, rehabbers have to teach them to fly, forwards and backwards. One of the busiest rehabbers in the country at one time was Terry Messier. Her memoir is Fastest Things on Wings, Rescuing Hummingbirds in Hollywood. And Terry joins us from the NPR studios. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. It's great to be here.
I cannot believe what a gripping read this is. It's like the Hunger Games for hummingbirds.
Well, that's nice to hear. I guess that's a compliment.
It is. Well, it opens with somebody on the phone with you as you realize that she's about 100 feet in the air on a pine tree on a cliff over the ocean. Why?
To rescue a nest of babies whose mother was trapped in her office and who died overnight.
The hummingbird was trapped in the woman's office, and you'd been, people call you. You're in the phone book. Rehabbers are. Had you studied hummingbirds? How did this happen?
No, I actually knew nothing about hummingbirds when I started. You know, my Abyssinian cat escaped from the house and brought a baby home and put it on the floor, and I didn't know what to do with it because it had come from outside. There was no way to put it back, so I located a rehabber. And then, of course, the next year, a baby got washed out of his nest in a ficus tree outside my house, and I became one of those crazy rescue people who had to climb up a ladder in a torrential downpour in my new wool suit that I had just put on for work that morning and bring him down and then take him to rescue. And after that, I got hooked. I became a rehabber myself.
Right. Studying under Gene Roper, the rehabber that you'd brought a bird to. And keep that bird in mind, people. the one that you first...
That's a very special bird.
Yes. We'll tell why in a minute. But so now, just recount some of the people you hear from. Yes, a woman 100 feet in the air over a cliff. But what are the lengths that other people go through to get to save hummingbirds?
Well, a lot of people jump into swimming pools fully clothed because they think the hummingbird can't swim. And in fact, hummingbirds can't swim, but they can float for a very long time. There are people who've faced down Rottweilers in neighbors' yards, run through traffic, and grabbed a bird out off the pavement.
People who call you and say, "My children fell in love with this hummingbird outside our window at the feeder. I have to save this hummingbird or else my children will hate me for the rest of my life." I mean, what is the attachment that people have?
Well, hummingbirds are disarmingly gorgeous, and there's something about them that's different from other birds, of course, because their flight skills are so unique and they're such aerial acrobats. But it's more than that. There's something about them that grips our heart and makes us really have a meltdown when we see them in distress.
And you've become a hummingbird expert. What did you learn about them that surprised even you?
That would have to be their emotional intelligence. There were several birds who had post-traumatic stress disorder, birds who wouldn't leave the aviary because they were upset about what had happened to them, all kinds of memories like that that you wouldn't think a little hummingbird with a brain the size of a BB would have, and yet they don't forget anything that happened to them ever.
Maybe they don't forget you. there's a bird that you first saw with Jean Roper. And at the time, she said to you, this is so unusual. This bird has such unusual coloring. And then this bird gets brought into you.
Right. Then he was returned because he had essentially migrated back to his birthplace. And then he got into a tangle with a limousine in Beverly Hills.
This is Gabriel. By the way. Yep.
So he was brought back to me, and because of his unusual markings, I knew that it was Gabriel. And in fact, his behavior when he came in was ridiculously familiar. He acted like we'd known each other forever, and I guess for him we had. So.
In hummingbird time. Much of the book is also a cautionary tale. Sort of the subheadline could be, do not try this at home. Give me a sense of your typical day in June when there is the most rescue to be had because of hatchlings and such. What is your day like?
We get 20 birds a day sometimes in June. Then you're running them through an educational process from the ICU through flight cages through an outdoor aviary that's kind of a simulated reality. But you also spend a lot of time in emotional therapy with the birds because they have their traumatic experiences, and you have to coax them away from that fear and make them feel like they can get back out there and do it.
Well,
they can live the wildlife.
So there's this emotional kind of encouraging them to go through the different steps of recovery. But every day, dozens of feeders have to be filled every 3 hours, washed at night. Formula has to be mixed, perches wiped down, plants trimmed and watered, bathtubs cleaned and filled, outdoor sugar feeders kept impeccably clean, cages scrubbed, mites removed. It's round the clock.
It's exhausting just hearing about it, Robin. The babies in the ICU have to be fed every 30 minutes, and that's just the beginning of the stress.
So, but you don't go out?
No, I can't go out. I became friends with people who lived close to me so that I could go to dinner in 20 to 30-minute increments.
So it's a lot of work, and some birds don't make it. You know, how do you make it through that?
That is the really hard part. 70 to 80% of our intakes get back out there healthy and strong, but the 20 or 30 that don't make it have to be, you know, kind of coaxed to a quiet end, and we just do it as compassionately and with as much love and humanity as we can.
That applies to rehabbers for every living thing. But then, on the other hand, these are wild animals, and you're very conscious of that. So how do you let them go? There was Pepper, a bird found in a catering dish. she'd been attacked by a male bird, which, you know, they can't distinguish between romance and attacks. And you ended up being very attached to her.
I did. Pepper and I bonded deeply. And one of the reasons I chose hummingbirds for rehabilitation is that they're not supposed to bond with people. But Pepper did. And Pepper wasn't the only one. Iris was another one. And Blacktop. And they all bonded. But Pepper was exceptionally close because of what she had gone through and because of the intense therapy I had to do with her. So, yeah, she was really unique.
So how do you let that, I mean, I can't imagine being that close to an animal, and then the goal is to let them go.
Yeah, well, then it's my turn to cry. Right?
Or the readers.
Yeah, exactly. You know, people cry when they bring them in, and I cry when I let them go.
Yeah.
So,
well, you've also learned so much that you want to impart to people. People think that babies are abandoned when they're not. What more do you want us to know about hummingbirds?
The main thing in rehab is to give people the caveat that you can't try to raise them yourself, because those are some of the most painful things we see in rehab, when people pick them up, take them home, and keep them too long because they think they're so cute. And I understand the attraction, but they've got to get to a rehabber right away if they're going to make it.
Well, that's hard sometimes. There was a woman who had projected her own abandonment issues on two nesting hummingbirds, and you're like, bring them in. And she...
Oh, I mean, this happens all the time. People project, and a lot of people believe that the hummingbirds are spirits of departed relatives who are inhabiting the hummingbirds that are outside. That's a really common belief. You wouldn't believe how often I hear that.
Really?
Yeah. Every day.
Well, so the biggest caution is bring them into a rehabber if they're hurt. Don't touch them because they may not be hurt. And call instead. How many calls do you get?
I got 2,000 calls this spring and summer.
Whoa.
So it depends on the time of year. By May, you're getting 10 to 20 a day. In June, sometimes up to 50 a day, if you can believe it.
It's understandable that hummingbirds would be in danger. They weigh less than a nickel. You know, they do these elaborate things like barrel rolls and somersaults and 360-degree rotation in midair, and sometimes that doesn't go well. They have to eat 200 fruit flies a day, so you let bananas rot so that you can always have fruit flies for them. And caution again to people, don't feed them things like ants. It'll kill them. Mm-hmm. But given that they're so tiny, why do you think they have such a big impact?
They're just magical. Hummingbirds have been sacred in Western cultures forever, ever since humans crossed paths with them. And when you look at a hummingbird, it's like a miniature mirror of our lives. They look so vulnerable and so helpless, even though they can be really mean, as you know, around feeders, and they're tough little guys. But when they're injured, they're the poster children for helplessness. And we have meltdowns when we look at them. I do, too, every time one comes into rehab. So I understand people's reactions that way. I never think people are too crazy anymore when they call me sobbing, because I've been there.
No. That's Terry Mazier. Her book, Fastest Things on Wings, Rescuing Hummingbirds in Hollywood. Terry, again, what a read. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And by the way, while Terry still takes hundreds of calls, it's recently from her new home in Portland, Oregon. Turns out this rehabber needed a little R&R herself, but she says she misses the hands-on and she plans on going back to L.A. Meanwhile, are you an animal rehabber of any kind? What's your life like? Let us know at hereandnow.org.
You may have noticed that gas prices are low, relatively. They could go lower. Interest rates remain attractively low, too. And so perhaps it's no surprise that Americans are buying cars. Ford announced today that in the past 3 months, it made $1.9 billion profit. That's a 44% jump from the same period a year ago. And this comes about a week after GM reported strong sales, too. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us with more on this. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with Ford. Why are they doing so well?
They're doing really well, as you just said. I mean, record-level sales. And most of it can be attributed to really strong demand for pickup trucks and sports utility vehicles. As you mentioned, gas prices are down. People are buying trucks. But they're not just buying, you know, your standard model truck. They want the higher-end models. Those are what's really boosting sales and boosting the income of Ford and also GM. But they're, you know, they're going for these models that have the massaging seats and panoramic roofs. So the chic pickup trucks is where it's at right now in this market.
Yeah, I see. And the best-selling vehicle in North America has been the F-150 pickup truck.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, they discounted the lower-priced model of this one, and now instead that's the XLT version of the F-150, and offering discounts of around $7,000. Which is, Ford says, is typical of, you know, in their business for end of model year. But overall, the share of $50,000 and up pickup trucks sold in the U.S. has more than doubled in the last 5 years.
And as we know, these companies are now global companies. How are sales overseas? Because we're hearing about the stock market having trouble in China, and obviously everything that's been going on in Europe with Greece. Is Ford doing well overseas, and are other auto companies?
Well, you know, indeed, things have gotten much more difficult overseas, particularly in Europe, where that's one part of the world where Ford reported losses in the second quarter of $14 million in Europe. Softer conditions in China, certainly, but Ford did post a record high 4.6% market share in China amid this broader economic slowdown. But they've had to, you know, adjust their expectations for the year as the stock market declines and heavy headwinds facing Ford and all these automakers overseas right now.
We did see that Volkswagen has sped past Toyota today to become the world's number one selling automaker. What is Volkswagen's secret? Why is it doing so well?
Why is it doing so well? Well, you're right. They outsold Toyota, and they said that its affiliate sales, Toyota's affiliate sales, were down 1.5% through June. Volkswagen said that it sold 5 million vehicles in the same period. GM was in third with 4.9 million vehicles. They're just having a good run at the moment. Their current models are doing extraordinarily well compared to Toyota in the U.S. market in particular.
That's Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal as we see some strong auto sales for the last few months. Ford announcing today that its profit was up 44% compared with the same period a year ago. Jason, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
A year ago, Vice President Joe Biden compared LaGuardia Airport in New York City to, quote, some third world country. Well, yesterday he was in New York to help Governor Andrew Cuomo unveil the plan to rebuild LaGuardia from scratch, which Governor Cuomo has called a terrible front door entranceway to New York. Joining us is Mitchell Moss, director of the Rudin Center for Transportation Policy and Management at New York University. And Professor, why does a major city in America have to have a modern airport, an airport that's competitive with the airports in London or Shanghai?
The United States is a huge continent. We travel by air to go from one city to another. Amtrak serves a small portion of the intercity traffic, as do buses. And so what we've seen today is that the airplane is the way in which most people travel when they're going over 300 miles. And when you want to go anywhere efficiently, you're going to take a plane. We need airports to allow cities to be connected to each other. New York and Los Angeles are very connected in terms of their economy, with technology, with media. So we have a flow of people back and forth. And so the airplane is the way in which people connect from one big region to another. And what we've seen is that some of the smaller towns have lost air service, but the big metropolitan areas are even more dependent upon their airlines and the service they get than ever before.
But why does it make sense for taxpayers to put up money to make the airport a modern, nice airport as opposed to more of a bus station?
Well, people do have choices. If an airport is going to add to delays, it becomes too difficult to come and go, then you're not going to have people wanting to live or even work in that region. Having a modern airport is, in fact, a requirement for major metropolitan areas. That's the way in which people come and go. But even goods today, the flowers you're used to getting overnight, the fresh fish, high-value cargo, whether it's a computer chip or others, that's coming in a body of a plane beneath where the passengers are sitting. Air cargo is vital, so you have to have an airport for any region to be competitive.
So why are we so behind in this country on keeping our airports up to date and cutting edge?
Well, I think some of the airports are actually quite up to date. San Francisco International, fabulous airport. Denver has a new airport built on a military base. There has been some vast improvements in many of the airports, and some of them still represent kind of an old-fashioned approach, such as LaGuardia. But around the country, we have seen upgrading of airports, but some of them are tied to the natural geographic limits. You go to San Diego, it's in downtown San Diego, right on the harbor. It can't do very much in terms of expansion. The airports, in fact, are limited by where they were initially placed. London especially. Heathrow is a great airport, but no one who lives around Heathrow wants it to build another runway, which is what it really needs.
The other question I have as we talk about the design of airports and making things more efficient is it appears that a lot of places are going to this model of having a rental car center, that you have to take a train from the terminal to get to the rental car center, which then will take you 15 minutes, and then you have to wait in line with everybody else. That seems inefficient to me, but that seems like that's the way we're going.
Well, I think you've hit on a key point. The access to the airport, the ground access to the airport, is very, very different from one city to another. So if you're going to certain California cities, if you're going to Orlando, everybody's going there and they're renting a car to get around. That's not the case in New York, where so many people are headed to Manhattan, where they just get in a cab or an Uber and go there. But if you're going to other destinations, particularly resorts, the rental car is the first stop after you get your bags.
Right.
If you have a business airport, that tends not to be the case. Sometimes you go straight to your hotel. So it does, I think, occur more and more that we're putting all the rental cars together in a garage at the edge and you have to use a tram. We're trying to reduce the amount of automobiles at the entrance to the airport. So putting the rental cars further away but easy to get to makes sense.
Well, and part of the plan here with LaGuardia is to have a train connect it more to Manhattan. A lot of people who travel through there probably wonder why that doesn't exist now.
Well, I think even if you put a direct train from the airport, most of the people coming into an airport are going to multiple locations spread around the whole region. And that's why you don't see these trains to the airport as widely used in North America as you might see in Europe. San Francisco, though, has BART. That works very well because so many people coming into San Francisco come into that airport and immediately go downtown or to one of the communities served by BART. So it's important to have a train that gives you connectivity not just to the downtown area but to other places where people are living and working.
What does it tell you, Mitchell Moss, that it's the year 2015 when the powers that be have finally decided it's time for a new LaGuardia?
Well, I think this is a result of Governor Cuomo recognizing that LaGuardia had been allowed to be neglected for too long. And sometimes it takes a crisis, it takes a breakdown. And I think that when Vice President Biden came to New York a while ago and said he thought it looked like an un-American airport, I think that triggered what had been already the plans to modernize it to make them even better.
That's Mitchell Moss, who is the director of the Rudin Center for Transportation Policy and Management at New York University. Thank you so much, Mitchell Moss.
Thank you.
If you want to see a really modern airport, go to Indianapolis, I'm telling you right now. Well, since 1875, the town of Superior, Arizona, has relied on copper mining to drive its economy, a reliance that has come at a cost as residents have endured cycles of mines opening and closing. Town officials are now hoping to put an end to that boom-bust cycle. Carrie Young from Here and Now contributor KJZZ reports.
At the Save Money Market in Superior, Arizona, grocer Michael Heng is doing one of his daily walkthroughs. He greets a few customers as he makes his way back to the produce section.
Hey, George. Hey, Dad.
With a population of just over 2,800 people, it's safe to say everyone in Superior knows each other. Heng's family's been in town since the 1920s, when his grandfather first opened this grocery store. Heng now runs things here, but he says it's that tight-knit nature that's helped his family and the community weather the many economic downturns that have come with being a mining town.
You know, I can't believe how my dad extended his credit line out to help the families in the community during the strikes and then even the shutdown.
Heng recounts a time in the 90s when the nearby Magma mine closed.
Superior was known at one time as Plywood City. The businesses were all boarded up. It just looked like a ghost town.
Today, plans are developing to open a new mine in the area, operated by Resolution Copper. For Heng, that's good news, because it promises to infuse the area with significant economic activity. But he adds, this time around, he's hoping area leaders use some of that cash flow to reinvest in the town and explore the prospect of attracting other industries, so Superior no longer has to rely on mining to survive.
We are certainly in the town of Superior trying to come to some agreement that would basically move the town away from a one-income employer to a diversified economy.
Stephen Cooper, Superior's town attorney, says the plan is to grow the area's tourism industry. He says town leaders hope to attract people who are already nearby, hiking the Arizona Trail, visiting the local arboretum, and driving through on U.S. 60. Cooper acknowledged before any of that can happen, the town needs to invest in its infrastructure.
And we're hoping that we can basically use this opportunity to not repeat the mistakes of the past and to try to diversify the economy.
Cooper says sources of funding include a tax on wages. He adds the town council is also hoping to negotiate a 0.1% tax on Resolution Copper's production.
No town really should be thinking, well, the mine's never going to close, because that's never been the case. Most mines have a useful life of at most a few decades.
Arizona State University economist Tom Rex says towns in Arizona have slowly been attempting to make this shift for about the last 40 years, but adds today the trend is picking up steam, thanks in part to improving transportation infrastructure, which allows residents to commute out of town for work and visitors to easily access an area for recreation, like, say, wine tasting. He says what it comes down to is whether or not an area can bring in enough money from outside the community.
Oh, it's possible. It's not necessarily an easy task. And every mining community is different.
So you're going to start with the Le Li. It's 100% Nebbiolo. And the fruit is from Graham County.
In central Arizona, the town of Jerome is one of a handful of towns that have successfully made the transition away from mining, with shops, restaurants, and wine tasting rooms like Caduceus Cellars lining the business district. Longtime resident and former mayor Richard Martin explains the tourism industry there took several decades to form.
When I first came to Jerome, you could walk down the middle of the street at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and nothing would happen. There were no cars, there was nothing.
And now, he says, you can barely find a parking space.
The town, you know, focused on the infrastructure, and it also focused on maintaining its historical heritage.
Back in Superior, grocer Michael Heng says he's hoping for something similar.
Everyone dreams of downtown Superior returning back like it was. Every shop filled. There was a clothing store. There was barber shops.
The Resolution Copper Mine is expected to begin production in 2026, which town officials say should be enough time to finalize plans to help turn that dream into a reality. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Young.
I thought I tore a putty cat. I did tore a putty cat.
Tweety Bird, spotting Sylvester. Funny, but in real life, not so much. At New York's Jones Beach, there's a battle between people who are feeding stray cats and bird lovers who want them killed because they're a threat to the endangered piping plover. And just this month, Australia's government decided that in order to protect its native wildlife, the government will kill 2 million stray or feral cats over the next 5 years. Vicky Croak, host of WBUR's The Wildlife Blog, has been watching all of this. So, Vicky, start with Australia. What's happening?
Hey, Robin. Well, Australia's Threatened Species Commissioner says the government is, quote, declaring war on feral cats, and it plans to shoot, poison, and bait them to get their numbers down. So cats were introduced there about 200 years ago. Since then, their population's increased to something like 20 million. And the government says that out of 28 out of 29 extinctions have been because of cats. They also say that cats in Australia kill 75 million animals every day. And that includes creatures like quolls and bandicoots. That's a reminder of Australia's uniqueness. And it's been isolated for millions of years. So the animals here are often found no place else in the world. But lots of people are outraged by Australia's decision. The actress and animal advocate Bridget Bardot, for one, came out swinging on the issue, condemning the government for its plan.
She's still active, so that's interesting.
That's right.
So Australia has that plan. And we've done stories here in the U.S. about how contentious this can be. People want to pass legislation in their neighborhoods to try to get even pets, cats, banned because they sit at bird feeders. So what's happening in the U.S. when it comes to feral cats?
Well, this is the million-dollar question, what to do about them. And it doesn't Australia, U.S., the U.K. Here in the United States, federal researchers say cats kill, get ready for this, 2.4 billion birds and 12.3 billion mammals each year. And for feral cat numbers, places like Humane Society of the United States say we probably have like 50 million feral cats. So how do we deal with that? So most big animal welfare groups advise that we keep our pet cats indoors. Stray cats who are socialized can be adopted out. But for feral cats, the cats who are not socialized to people, animal welfare groups tend to support something called TNR. That's trap, neuter, and release. Groups in any given community trap the feral cats there. They spay or neuter them. They vaccinate them. And then they return the cats back to where they came from. Mm. And they say this stabilizes, and over time it decreases any cat population. But many conservationists completely disagree. And I spoke to Grant Sizemore. He's the director of invasive species programs at the American Bird Conservancy, or ABC. And here's what he had to say.
The scientific evidence overwhelmingly indicates that TNR simply does not effectively reduce feral cat populations. Removal is far more efficient and practical. And one simple fix for TNR is actually just enclosing the feral cat colony.
Well, wait a minute. I mean, herding cats comes to mind. Can
That's
you enclose
right.
a feral cat colony?
It can be done. It's expensive, and lots of people absolutely disagree with it. I talked to Carter Luke, and he's the head of the Massachusetts Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and they're taking I mean, here's a guy who's a cat guy, and he's also a very thoughtful voice on lots of animal welfare issues. And the MSPCA, while they don't directly run a TNR program of their own, they do support groups, but they are taking a very wide view of the issue. And it's interesting. For them, it's not either or. They're using something like a public health model. So they gathered zip codes of people dropping off unwanted cats in the shelters that they run. And from them, they've identified at-risk areas and then targeted those hot zones by providing low-cost sterilization for cats and also education to owners there. And Luke says there's been a big drop in numbers of cats coming into MSPCA shelters over the last 5-10 years, maybe something like a 75% reduction. And he says that has to mean fewer feral cats, too. Mm. So here's what he had to say.
Huge decreases, and that's because we've been targeting at-risk populations. When we keep the population under control, what it means is shelters have the ability to deal with the animals that are homeless in a more constructive way than euthanasia, and it means there are fewer cats reproducing out in the community in a free-roaming state.
Well, and Vicky, I just one last thought on this. This can get very violent. I mean, we hear that there's a firefighter in Los Angeles who was sentenced after he knocked a woman unconscious because she was feeding feral cats.
That's right. And in other places, there have been alleged birders or conservationists who have shot or poisoned feral cats in the name of conservation.
So this is something people have to take up. Meanwhile, while we have you, we want to talk about a big cat, a famous wild lion named Cecil in Zimbabwe. It's believed he was killed illegally, and now there's news that it might have been a dentist in the Midwest in the U.S. This was a beloved lion.
That's right. This guy, he was a gregarious black maned lion. Everyone loved him. He was very popular, and the word is conflicting now, but he was wearing a GPS collar. That's illegal to shoot one, and he was lured outside the park, we hear, in order to be shot. Very sad, and it will affect lions for generations to come.
Well, the Telegraph of London is reporting that the person who shot the lion, Cecil, paid tens of thousands of dollars to do it and is a dentist from the Midwest. So we want to pay more attention to that as well. And you tell us, as an animal lover, obviously this lion's cubs will die.
That's right. The male, a new male taking over will kill the cubs to get the females back in cycle so they'll reproduce his cubs.
Terrible story. I want to stay on that and see who did that. Vicky Croak, thank you as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.